I think by now, with everybody watching the World Cup, or even just seeing how the Super Bowl plays out, or if you live in a city like I do, in the Bay Area, where there's big conversation about the building of stadiums and how they're able to find money for that through private sector and sometimes the government sector, but they can't find money for schools, then you should understand that sports is a very political thing. My own anecdotes is that, and this is just my own critique, I think that many of us on the left look at sports in a way that's kind of down our noses. 60,000 people show up to a Raider game. 60,000 people show up to a 49er game. That's our people. Those are our neighborhoods. And I'm very surprised that more of us don't go out there to make connections, even just to get information out. It's just common sense. You know, you're having a rally, anti-war rally, 60,000 people in front of a thing. That's a good place to start, you know, politicizing people. I remember having a conversation during the 2006 or 7 election between Arnold Schwarzenegger and Phil Angelides' people. And I made the suggestion to the Democrats they should go to the Raider game. And I was told, you know, they looked at me and asked me what sort of campaign have I ever run. I do radio, so, and our radio station is number one in the market, so we had to be with the people every week. So they didn't listen. They thought it was stupid. But Arnold Schwarzenegger showed up at the Raider game, the Oakland Raiders versus the San Diego Padres. Now, Stevie Wonder can see that. That's both California teams, north and south, in one location. He shows up, walks around, buys people beers, you know, does the Arnold Schwarzenegger thing, and people still talking about the fact that he showed up to the game. Not only that, he got airtime and press time, and many of those people probably just on the strength alone of him showing up voted for him without knowing the issues. So I bring that up just to say that sports and people who either find it as an escape or a sense of pride because, you know, I wear my Raider chain, I'm an Oakland fan, I represent that. You know, people feel that way about their countries, you know, when we talk about World Cup and all that. So, I mean, it's a very passionate thing, and I think we need to learn some lessons as to how to tap into that. We also need to know what is really driving some of this stuff behind the scenes on a political level. So that's just it on how I feel. We have some people that can definitely speak to this in more in depth. A good friend of mine, he's an author of several books. Dave Zirin, you know him as The Edge of Sports. He writes for The Nation magazine. And yeah, and he's a cool cat sometimes. So give it up for Dave Zirin. I just met this gentleman here today. I heard the name before. His name is Mike James. He's the co-founder and board member for Athletes United in Peace. And so he's for peace, did I say? Okay, sorry about that. Athletes United for Peace. There you go. Let's give it up to him. She's also, this woman here is part of our Hard Knock family. She's one of our, you know, contributors all the time. But she's also a dynamic organizer who clearly understands the importance of cultural symbols and cultural expression, especially in the arena of art, and how that becomes a very, very compelling and powerful tool for communication. And so if you get on her bad side and she needs to shut you down, she doesn't even have to get on a mic, you know, but she has ways to communicate, especially with her art, which is very compelling and very exciting. Her name is Faviana Rodriguez. So let's give it up for her. I want to start off with Dave Zirin because, you know, I talk to you all the time, and we actually had this conversation last week in Washington, D.C. about the politicization of sports. Can you all hear me? Is that clear? You need me to talk louder? Okay, I'm sorry. So stand up, Dave, and let me just start with you. If you could talk to people, let's start off with the obvious, the World Cup and the politicization behind that. How significant is sports when you look at it from that perspective, and why we need to understand, you know, need to understand it better?
My goodness. Well, first of all, how's everybody doing? Everybody all right? Cool. I want everybody to know we're here just before, because we're talking about South Africa anyway, and I was in South Africa in the precursor to the World Cup, walking from Johannesburg to Durban and back. Not literally, but it felt like that. And the way people on the South African left, when they start talks, they, you know, they start by saying Amandla, which means power, and people back say Owetu. And one person who was famous for doing that in particular was a gentleman who died this past year named Dennis Brutus, who was really like the poet of the South African freedom struggle. And Dennis was like a short dude. He kind of looked almost like Yoda. And but Dennis, he could Amandla with the best of them. So I wanted to start just by us doing an Amandla, because they're making their noise over there. So I'm going to say Amandla, and you guys say Owetu, and let them hear it upstairs. Amandla!
Owetu!
Amandla!
Owetu!
Amandla!
Owetu!
Now that's how you start a sports talk. Okay. Look, World Cup. They say, oh, sports and politics don't mix. You can't even step off the plane in South Africa without seeing how these things are colliding right now. In South Africa right now, the World Cup, first of all, let me just be clear. I'm a soccer fan. I love the World Cup. Just football. Should we? I'm going to call it soccer because in South Africa they call it soccer. So we're just going to do that. Actually, man, I see this guy's going to give me a hard time. Okay, which is fine. Isn't that part of the social forum? I don't know, are there hecklers in other social forum meetings? I'm not sure. Oh, there are. Okay, good. So in the best traditions of the social forum. All right. So in South Africa, check this out. Soccer is loved. Football is loved. It is a sports-mad society without question, and there is a tremendous amount of pride at being able to host the World Cup. But I would describe it as one-third pride, two-thirds major apprehension at the disruption that's accompanied their lives. Because South Africa is the richest country in sub-Saharan Africa. It also is ranked 31st among African countries in life expectancy. So the gap between rich and poor is unbelievable, and it's actually gotten worse since the fall of apartheid. Since the fall of apartheid, white income has actually gone up 24%. Black income has gone up 1%, but that's a very misleading figure because you've had the development of a black working of a black middle class and political class, while for the poorest of the poor, like, conditions are just absolutely terrible. And you see this in the World Cup, which is like this neoliberal Trojan horse that's being sent into the country. And just let me give you an idea of the contempt that South Africa's current rulers have for people in the country. This is a quote from Danny Jordaan, who's in charge of South African soccer. And he said, this is what he said after he was asked a question by an interviewer saying, you're spending, $4 billion on stadiums in a country where people are starving to death, don't have clean water. How do you justify that morally? How do you justify that, especially since you already have working stadiums? And Danny Jordaan says, yes, they tell us we should build hospitals instead of stadiums, but we are selling dreams, and no child grows up wanting to go to a hospital. Now, you think about that for a second. If you don't have health care, you actually do grow up dreaming of wanting to go to a hospital. But that's beyond the thinking of Danny Jordaan, because the thinking is so absolutely separate from how people are living their lives there right now. Now, I could talk more about it. I could talk about other stuff. I could talk about Los Sons.
Let's talk a little bit about that. Yeah.
You want to hear about Los Sons?
You know, let's. That would be one example. Let's talk a little bit about
it. Can I tell a story?
Sure.
All right, first, can I just tell a story? Because of my view of sports. This is an absolute true story that I absolutely swear is true. You have to believe me that it's true. Do we have an agreement? At least you'll give me the benefit of the doubt? Okay. Thank you. Man. A couple years ago, I went to a bookstore. It was a radical collective bookstore, which we all support and we all should support, independent bookstores that are operate on this model. And I was, and it was in a city that I don't really want to name. All right, it was Philadelphia. And I walked in the store, and a good, you know, young radical, young gentleman came up to me and said, "Oh, how you doing? What are you doing here? Welcome to the store." And I just said, "Hi, I'm Dave Zirin. I'm here to talk about my book." And he said to me, "But you're white." And I said, "Well, yeah, last I checked, I'm white." And he said, "But isn't that you on your book?" That's a true story. I swear to God. And I said to him, "No, that's actually Muhammad Ali. That's not me." And then, and I swear this happened, and I know Favi's heard this story and Davey's heard this story, and so this is totally true. I was asked why I felt like it was worth my time and energy to write a book about Mr. T. And, because you see, it's, what's my name, fool? And it was like, no, that's I pity the fool, not what's my name, fool. And I was looking around this store, and you have posters up of people like Emma Goldman and Malcolm X and all the icons you can imagine. And there's no knowledge of somebody, Muhammad Ali, who is the most famous draft resister in the history of the United States. And the idea that we as a radical culture have not claimed that for our own, the idea that we're not out there being like, yeah, I'm against this war in Afghanistan, I'm against this war in Iraq, I stand in the tradition of Muhammad Ali. We should be saying that and trumpeting it to the hills. And the fact that we don't have that basic knowledge says to me that we are actually writing off a good portion of our own history that needs to be reclaimed. And so I'm going to skip ahead of everything I was going to say just to say this. It's like a current chapter of that history is being written right now in Arizona. And we need to claim that history before someone comes up to me and asks me if I'm Steve Nash. Now, in that history, Favi's going to talk about one aspect of that history, and that's the way the Arizona Diamondbacks are really becoming like a pariah team in Major League Baseball, the traveling roadshow of the disgusting racist laws in Arizona right now, like SB 1070, which I'm sure people are familiar with, the banning of ethnic studies, which I'm sure people are heard all about. And there are three reasons why, by the way, people here should protest the Arizona Diamondbacks wherever you can. First of all, these laws that they've passed in Arizona, they're built for export. And they want to send them to at least 13, 14 other states. So when you protest the Diamondbacks, you're actually laying down a marker in your own state that says this will not stand. Second reason, the owner of the Arizona Diamondbacks is a guy named Ken Kendrick. When I say his name, you guys should boo. I want to try that again. The owner of the Arizona Diamondbacks is a guy named Ken Kendrick. Good. I don't know if anybody here has ever been to a synagogue recently, but on Purim, you know, you say Haman and everybody goes boo. All right, not a big synagogue crowd. That's cool. No worries. I'm a Jewish anti-Zionist myself, so that's the cool. Or the jazz band, you know, jazz, Jewish anti-Zionist. Sorry. Thank you. Now the heckler likes me. To get back on point here, so Ken Kendrick is one of the big backers of the Republican Party that's pushed this stuff through. He even holds fundraisers inside the owner's box for the politicians who pushed this stuff through in a stadium that was built with $250 million of money. And the third reason why people should protest the Diamondbacks is fuck Arizona. Seriously, fuck them. Every single thing they've passed should be protested. I don't even drink Arizona iced tea anymore, and it's made in Brooklyn. You know, it's like that state should be a pariah state until these laws are overturned. And so the last point just to say is that one of the things that struggle produces, frankly, because of the work of people like Faviana and the people who've been protesting, meant that the Phoenix Suns during their playoff run did not want to become that pariah team. And so they came out as one and wear jerseys on Cinco de Mayo that read simply Los Suns. And they did it for a couple of reasons, and then I'll sit down, and you should cut me off whenever, and people, I guess it's social forum, people can just raise your hand or twinkle if you want me to sit down. Was that for sitting down? Okay, good. All right. Like, the first reason why first of all, this has never happened in the history of sports. In the history of sports, a team has never come out and said, we oppose a racist law. We oppose an unjust law. It would be like if the 69 New York Jets had said, we oppose the Vietnam War, and Joe Namath leading the charge. Because the person leading the charge on the Phoenix Suns was their MVP point guard, Steve Nash. He came forward and he said, I love him too. Love he Nash. Said, it's racial profiling, things we don't want to see and don't need to see in 2010. Their all-star power forward, Amari Stoudemire, who has zero political reputation to speak of, said, we're going to wear Los Suns to let the Latino community know we're behind them 100%. And my favorite was their general manager, now he's their ex-general manager, Steve Kerr, who first said he was kind of uncomfortable with the whole thing, like a team taking a political stand because it had never been done before. Then he got at a whole weekend of getting racist emails from the lovely people from Arizona and beyond, and he did an interview and he said, it's hard to imagine in this country that we have to produce papers. It rings up images of Nazi Germany. Damn. But what it led to, which was, I think, more incredible and which frankly reached more people, I mean, unfortunately, but it's a fact, than 100 social forums, was the broadcast that night on TNT, which was watched by an estimated 10 million people around the country. Because it was like no basketball telecast you've ever seen in your life. Just raise your hands if you saw that game. Okay, it's a minority of people, but that's enough to say. Like the pregame first of all, involved, there was a 5,000-person protest outside the arena that was led by Phoenix Mayor Phil Gordon and Al Sharpton, both wearing Los Suns jerseys. And it was so wild that they sent the TNT sideline reporter out there to cover the march. Now, I don't know if you guys are familiar with basketball telecasts, but sideline reporters are usually on the intelligence scale, somewhere between, like, a soda can and ex-governors of Alaska. They're in that with the soda can up here. That's your typical sideline reporter. And this guy was no exception. This is what he said from the march. He said, "Well, I'm out here at the march, and I want to report back that there's no violence. And fortunately, everything is calm. Back to you, Ernie." And then he kicked it back to Ernie Johnson, who's the host, and he had former players Kenny the Jet Smith, Charles Barkley, and Chris Webber there. And Ernie Johnson tried to immediately, you know, bring it back to the game, and he said, "So what do you guys think of what the game?" And Kenny Smith jumped in, and he said, "Wait a minute, I have to say something about that comment that there is no violence." By the way, everything I'm reading is quotes, because I'm, like, watching this, like, oh, my God, you know. So Kenny Smith said, wait, I have to say something about that comment that there is no violence. What does he think, the mayor's going to slap somebody? And then Charles, just true. And then Charles Barkley said, "You know Al Sharpton's not going to slap somebody, he'll mess up that hairdo." Now, Barkley is a longtime Arizona resident. He once said he was a Republican until the Republicans lost their damn minds. And this is what Barkley then said, just extemporaneously. He just said it. He said, "Immigrants aren't the problem. The only people screwing it up are the politicians. You know, living in Arizona for a long time, the Hispanic community, they're like the fabric of the cloth. They're part of the community. And anytime you try to do any type of racial profiling or racial discrimination, it's wrong. The politicians are the problem." Now, Chris Webber then upped the ante, interrupting now There was now a visibly uncomfortable Ernie Johnson, right, saying, "Let's talk about the game." And Chris Webber said, "You know, Public Enemy said it a long time ago." "By the time I get to Arizona, I'm not surprised. John McCain didn't even want there to be a Martin Luther King Day. So if you follow history, you know that this is part of Arizona politics." Ernie Johnson then proceeded to have a stroke.
Stop there for a second.
I'm going to bring in Mike James
in a second. But I have one question. Just a quick follow-up, if you could just do this. Because there was two things. One, it's true. The Arizona situation did put this on Front Street for a lot of people. A lot of people I'm coming across didn't know about SB 1070 till they heard it on the basketball thing. So there was that power of these athletes having all this spotlight saying something, as opposed to a Michael Jordan who might not have done that, you know, and had come under criticism once upon a time for having the spotlight and always being quiet. But if you also remember, some of that pushback came with, you know, my beloved Lakers with, you know, with the coach there, Phil Jackson, who came out and basically, you know, seemed to suggest that he was for SB 1070, which was counted by Kobe's wife, who made headlines by reading wearing a shirt that said that she's, what was the shirt again?
Do I look illegal?
So, I mean, the question is one, why don't we see more athletes doing like a Steve Nash and speaking up and saying that? And, you know, when you see somebody like a Phil Jackson doing what he did and seeing the pushback, does that make these athletes become more scared and sit down and say, "I'm not going to do anything at all"?
Yeah, it's interesting. When Phil Jackson said that, there was actually a picket in front of the Staples Center before a playoff game, which is amazing in and of itself. That's sort of like doing an abortion rights protest at the Vatican. I mean, they went out there and picketed Phil Jackson in front of the Staples Center. And that's an important ingredient to this, because people ask me that all the time about, like, why don't more athletes speak out? And the first thing I always answer is, well, why don't more people speak out? Because one thing you learn historically is that athletes do not lead on these questions. Like, when people march off the athletic field, it can ricochet with electric results on the athletic field. Tommy Smith and John Carlos, for example, at the 68 Olympics. Billie Jean King fighting sexism. Martina Navratilova for LGBT rights. These things happen because of movements that people build off the field. And without those movements off the field, you don't see a reflection on the field. But what's so important is that when it gets on the field, the amplification is like nothing else. I mean, Stokely Carmichael, the great Stokely Carmichael, later Kwame Ture, he once said that Muhammad Ali, he used to talk to Muhammad Ali on the phone, and he said Muhammad Ali was more dangerous than I could ever be. Not because he had better politics than I did, but because of the platform that he commanded. And that's why they had to get him. That's why they had to shut him down.
Something to think about. Let's give it to Dave Zirin. Can you stand up, Mike? Is that cool? Right now we have Mr. Mike James, co-founder. What are we going to do?
Favi, Trevor, Mike.
I'm last.
Oh, you're last. Okay.
Last.
So then we're going to take our attention over to Faviana. Okay. I didn't get the script. You know. There you go. Go ahead, Favi.
Okay. Oh, hi, everybody. My name is Faviana. And before I start a little bit about the campaign we're running now, which is Move the Game, I want to just give a little history. Thank you. So I'm an artist. I'm not a sports fan until recently, when I had to kind of become one. I'm an artist, and I really see and an organizer. And I always understood the power of organizing. Really came when we got into pop culture, and so I do that through posters, through web stuff. And I'm co-founded an organization called Presente.org about a year ago, and one of our initial projects was getting Lou Dobbs off the air from CNN. In 2009. And so Lou Dobbs represented 10 years of anti-immigrant bashing on CNN. I mean, he would say things like, illegal immigrants are murderers and rapists, and they're bringing leprosy, and they make up one-third of the prison population. He said this. And so he would also have anti-immigrant groups like the Minutemen on, FAIR, the Federation for American Immigration Reform, which are known by the Southern Poverty Law Center to be hate groups. And so along this time, you also saw an escalation of hate crimes against Latinos, which went up in like 6 years, 33%. So Lou Dobbs represented for Presente.org an opportunity for us to really hit a multinational corporation and demand that CNN, the most trusted name in news, get off, remove Lou Dobbs from the air. And Presente.org was born out of the whole tradition of Move On, which is that how could we nationally build a power base when, in 2006, you had millions of Latinos march around the country, and yet we were not in any way connected via technology. We were not emailing each other. Color of Change had already had Color of Change, which is kind of like the Black Move On, which emerged after Katrina. And there was nothing like that for Latinos. And so that was born kind of as an effort to unify the voices. And also because Latinos are becoming, in some states, the majority in the next, in the next 5 or 10 years. And yet technology had not really aided us. And so the Lou Dobbs campaign, we were able to get 100,000 petitions in the 25 largest Latino media markets to tell CNN they had to let him go, and he resigned in November. So based on that campaign, running that and kind of traveling all around, I think many of us understood the possibility of what we could do as Latinos to really challenge multinational corporations. And then Arizona happens. So when Arizona SB 1070, does everyone know what SB 1070 is? Okay, well, yeah, I'll explain SB 1070. So, Arizona, who is a border state and for years has passed some of the worst legislation, introduced one of, like, I actually think right now it's the worst anti-immigrant legislation in any state. And so usually immigration policy is dictated by the federal government, right? And so a program called 287G emerged, which is something that has, been very widely spread under Obama, sadly. 287G is a program that allowed police to collaborate with ICE. And that means that if you have a broken taillight and you get pulled over, mm-hmm. and you look brown, someone can run you against the federal database and then deport you. And in Arizona, that has meant Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who is considered one of the most number one enemies of immigrants because of how he separates families and mothers and children. So Arizona is ground zero. It is immigration policy gone bad on steroids. And so when SB 1070 came into effect, which would basically say that if anyone looks suspicious of being undocumented, they can get pulled over. But also, that if the state somehow was not upholding the law, SB 1070, that they could get sued. It represented just a whole new shift in anti-immigrant policies. And what's worse is that there was a lot of talk about copycat laws. So when that happened, immediately we said, how can people who are not in Arizona organize around this besides us all convening in Arizona? And one of those ways was through hitting Arizona economically. And so we, you know, many groups around the country really try to study, well, how do we hit Arizona? Arizona, one of their number one kind of imports for the state is tourism. How else? Well, they're going to have the All-Star Games. And that's when really fast I had to like really understand, you know, the power of sports. And, you know, Dave Zirin, I was on a panel with him in Socialism 2009. And one thing that as we began talking to groups around the country, we noticed, you know, and also, you know, forgive me, I'm not a sports fan, so I had to like really kind of understand how this worked, was that understanding in some of these major Latino markets like Chicago, El Paso, Los Angeles, the amount of economic power that people who attended baseball games had, basketball games, was really significant. And so if just looking at it from a strategic point of view, targeting Major League Baseball and really pushing Bud Selig, who is the Major League Baseball commissioner, pushing him to move the All-Star Game out of Arizona represented for us the largest opportunity to hit Arizona, just like the NFL hit them when they would not, when they refused to celebrate MLK Day. It represented an economic hit to Arizona that they would, it would be very, very hard for them to recover from. That, along with, you know, civic engagement, because the other part of this is how we're going to vote, you know, Jan Brewer out, and then also getting on the ground organizing, an economic hit, an on the ground organizing hit, and then an all out national denouncement of Arizona was the best thing that we could do. So Bud Selig became our target, and after kind of really thinking about, you know, who do we apply pressure to when we're thinking about having to move the game, we then kind of understood we did a power analysis, and Bud Selig, who was the commissioner, became the best target. And so then we began organizing in different cities. Like in Los Angeles, we had a big protest at the Dodger game. Some of the what we've been doing is asking on the ground organizers to write to their local group, their local teams, their baseball teams, ask them to denounce Bud Selig and to ask the commissioner to move the game out of Arizona in 2011. We've also asked them to make a statement against SB 1070. And really, there's an opportunity here to engage baseball fans. And also, you know, many of these baseball fans, especially if you're looking at in the major Latino cities, there's a big chunk of them that are Latino. And so there's an opportunity there to educate, but also to say, you know, should baseball fans care? Yes, we have a huge ability to have economic power and to really kind of change the direction of this law. The other thing is that once we started having protests, you know, we had something at the Miami game. We not only have protests when there's when the Diamondbacks play, but anytime there's a major game, we try to have a presence there so that in the media, you know, once we saw the game with Los Suns, and I was there when Dave was talking about it on Democracy Now, and he said that what happened is that we were able to really inject into the broadcast. That's something that we need to be replicating, because when we're there, you know, at the LA one, I think there was about 1,000 protesters who marched. And if you take a look over there, you can see some of the images. And they marched with, you know, strike out SB 1070, movethegame.org. That's the website we've set up, movethegame.org. And that's where we've already gathered over 150,000 petitions that we are going to deliver to Bud Selig. The interesting thing also is that, you know, Bud Selig lives in Milwaukee. So I don't know if there's anyone here from Minnesota.
Wisconsin.
Excuse me. Hi. Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah, so the Major League Baseball headquarters are in New York, but, you know, Bud Selig's our target. And so the next thing we're going to do is look at how we deliver the 150,000 petitions. And, you know, Dave Zirin here is helping us with some strategy around figuring out how we get players to sign on. We've had a really hard time actually in New York when we were trying to hit up some of the players. Initially, there was a lot of excitement right after Los Suns thing, and then all of a sudden there was almost like a dead silence from players that we were not, you know, even some of the Latino players who had previously spoken out, we were not able to secure, you know, their commitment. So it's very important that all of you, I encourage you to visit movethegame.org, and that has a kit on what you can do in your local city, because all of you can organize your local town, you can write, you know, op-ed letters. The key thing here is that the sports world offers us an opportunity to engage in politics and to really talk about how politics has everything to do with sports. There's a direct correlation here. And the other thing, Dave, I don't know if you could explain this one, is how right now, like, the players who are doing their training in Arizona, the Latino players got these ID cards just in case they get pulled over. Like, I mean, it's ridiculous. So, you know, those kinds of opportunities, though, open the doors for us to kind of come in and say, because the players are already feeling it, they're very visibly targets themselves, is to open the door and say, hey, you know what, this law is wrong, and help us in really making sure that Arizona feels the economic pressure.
I have a question for you, Favi. Let's give it up for her.
And
I know there's a sense of urgency because SB 1070 may go into effect in a month or so. But as a long-term strategy, and even as a short-term, what about hitting participants that are younger, that aren't necessarily in the major leagues or in these professional realms, but along the college lines, the sandlots, high school? So at least they start to get the taste of being politicized and can get used to having political conversations. So when they get older, when issues like this come up, they can talk.
Yeah, I mean, well, definitely, it actually, through Presente.org, there's also another group called Voto Latino, and we've known, in the United States, the most active kind of base of the Latino community is people under 25. They are the ones who most are voting, they're writing, they're blogging, they're on Twitter, they're on Facebook, they're very active when it comes to politics, and so that's definitely a constituency that matters to us, and likewise, it also, we need to be reaching out to that constituency. But one thing I want to add is that in terms of this being a short-term, long-term thing, we know just from intelligence from the White House that Obama is going to declare this law, and they're going to try to overturn this law and say it's not constitutional. But the reality is that SB 1070 happened because of Obama's misguided 287G program. And so the long-term aspect of this is that SB 1070 offers us an opportunity to talk about immigration law in general. Because right now, you know, if you look at a spectrum and you look at here legalization for the 12 million undocumented, and you look at criminalization, the needle is going so far towards criminalization that we are having to react to laws like SB 1070. And even if you start talking about the contribution of immigrants, we are just so far off from there that we need to begin to, SB 1070 is the opportunity for people to learn about 287G. 287G, Maricopa County, you know, under Obama, we have 1,000 deportations a day. Not even under Bush did we have that. 400,000 detentions and deportations, immigrants dying in custody. So in reality, this is part of a failed immigration plan under the Obama administration. And so this opportunity is an opportunity for us to educate, you know, that immigrants are a very vital part of the economic foursome in this country. So thank you.
Okay. So I think we're going to go to Trevor, but I'm seeing if he got the Skype in. How's it looking, Jeff?
Anti-privatization, leaders of the social movements there. We're really incredibly lucky to have them with us live to talk about what's been going on there. So please give them a quick and warm welcome. And gentlemen, we've got Dave Zirin on the panel, Mike James, Fabiano Rodriguez, and Davey D is going to do some questions with you.
Would we talk right here?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Great.
Trevor, I guess the first thing is your reflections on what is taking place at the World Cup, and how should, you know, people in this gathering look at it? What should we take from it, especially on a political activist tip?
Basically, the World Cup is not a good idea for a country like South Africa. I mean, if I dare say for any country, because it's just one big circus, money-making circus for the FIFA mafia. And in our case, it's a distraction from priorities and problems facing millions of people, such as, you know, poor housing, poor healthcare, poor education. At the moment, we've got, you know, youth unemployment is said to be above 80%. So we think that, you know, this is the wrong priority for our government. I don't wish the World Cup on any country.
Let me ask you this. You know, the way that they presented it on TV, we got to see, like, the freedom fighters. They did all these different documentaries, you know, about how, like, when Nelson Mandela was in jail, everybody was playing soccer, and this somehow brought people together, the sport of football. Does it or does it not bring people together? Is there any sort of positive attributes that we can put towards, you know, the sport?
Yeah, well, few things in this world, you know, don't have positive and negative. So, admittedly, there is a sense of we're all South Africans, you know, among some people, and also, you know, people supporting the national team. Although, as you know, we've just been knocked out. We're the first World Cup host, you know, to lose. You know, the first round. Yeah, so it's there, but most of it is mostly kind of created, you know, here we call it spin doctoring. It's been spin doctored, you know, the government, the top politicians, the media, you know, big business, the churches, you know, everyone is kind of promoting and buying so that ordinary people end up feeling that it's a good thing. So I can say from the point of view of mass propaganda, you know, it's been a great success. Okay, the unity, yeah, you know, it's fine because we are, you know, from a history of division, apartheid. So, but what I noticed was that, you know, firstly, it was the middle class or, you know, those with some money, extra money to, you know, attending the stadia because the tickets were expensive, you know, and most workers, ordinary workers, blue-collar workers, you know, couldn't get time off to watch the games and so on. But I'm just worried that maybe it's a false kind of unity, you know, and it's going to evaporate very quickly as soon as economic realities hit, you know, after the World Cup is gone. The other thing is that I don't know whether it's fair, but, you know, just for argument's sake, I would say we're a young democracy, so-called young nation. So we do exhibit some immaturity. So the people here tend to be fickle, you know, so they get swayed quite easily. For example, when the national team lost, people are now saying, you know, was it worth it? And then it won against France. Now, there's mixed feelings. But I think in the long run, you know, the magic is going to evaporate and we'll be back to square one, especially for the poor, for the working class, those at the bottom of the social ladder.
We're going to see if we have a couple of questions while we have you on. Anybody got a question? Go ahead. Step up here so we can hear you. Come on down. We have a question.
So part of our workshop is how we can leverage sports activities to increase political activity and awareness. What are you all doing there to get the world to know more about what's happening in South Africa on the real side now that the world's eyes are on you?
Okay, I'll start by efforts, you know, directed at, you know, the people here. For example, in Cape Town, we've got a social movement called the Anti-Eviction Campaign. So they had an alternative World Cup games where, you know, they were using that to build, you know, a real foundation for unity, pointing out people's problems and calling for people, you know, to unite against the problems facing them and so on and so forth. And here in Durban, we had a march on June 16. Remember June 16? That's in 1976, you know, the apartheid government mowed down hundreds of kids who were fighting for freedom. In a way, the struggle and the victory against apartheid, you know, found a turning point in June 16. So we used that day to actually have a march, and it was well attended, and we raised our grievances. And the main purpose of the march was to say the government has got wrong priorities. You know, it should reprioritize, not sports as in, you know, mega sports, mega parks, mega stars, mega money, you know, but rather, you know, sports development, healthcare, houses. So we're trying to seek a more sustainable basis for unity and solidarity among communities, among the poor, among the working class, and those who support their cause.
Okay, let me see if we have time for one more. Any other person? Come on up here. And we'll take one more after that, so you might want to get over there if you do. What's your question?
I just wanted to ask you, I know that leading up to the World Cup, there was a shack city where everyone that was living in shacks there, they was talking about building a resistance movement to the World Cup. And I just wanted to know how did they do on that, and how did that turn out?
Okay, the World Cup is not yet over. So, you know, people are still organizing. Like I say, there have been a few matches. There'll be more matches next week or the week after. I think we are likely to have more success now because, you know, many people are getting kind of bored with the World Cup, you know, and a bit disillusioned. And all the hype, you know, a great nation, you know, is kind of wearing off. And, you know, people spend a lot of money on the World Cup because it was presented as some kind of one big party. People had to buy booze, drink, street parties. So I think many ordinary people are in debt now. But as I say again, you know, we're faced with a tremendously huge and effective propaganda machinery. But, you know, we are slowly chipping away. And I think in the long term, this might pay off.
Well, I think that, okay. Trevor, we want to thank you for taking time out and sharing with us. We're going to let you go, and we're going to finish the rest of the panel. So thank you for sharing with us, okay?
Thank you.
Yeah, so let's do this.
Dan, can you give his name again, the organization?
Yes, he could do that. Okay. Yeah. I'm going to have to bounce for a second because I just get these urgent texts that the hotel that I'm at is like, you have to check out, like, right now. So I'm like, yeah. So Fabiana, because she hosts the show too, she's going to do hosting duties. So thank you very much.
Let me just make a little segue. So just so folks know, they want to look up Trevor's work. Very prolific writer.
It's already said.
Profound writer, and tremendous leader.
Nguane is his last name, Ngwane. He's an organizer for the Anti-Privatization Forum and also the Soweto Electricity Crisis Committee. If you go to ZNet, many of you may be familiar with ZNet, he has a profile on ZNet with a lot of his writings, and many people here actually at the Social Forum are familiar with his work. So we want to thank him again, and thank you for bearing with some of the technical challenges there. And now I'm really pleased to introduce Mike James. As Davey mentioned earlier, Mike is one of the co-founders and a board member of Athletes United for Peace, a tremendous organization. Dave Zirin is also affiliated with Athletes United for Peace. Many other famous athletes you may know, if you go to their website, I really want to encourage you to check it out. Mike will give you the URL. One thing that he's really going to talk about is the organization's work, but also, you know, we've done a lot of, and appropriately so, critiquing of the challenges and problems that we have with sports. But there's a certain kind of sports that's from above, again, mostly corporate controlled, often controlled by universities. But we all know that millions of people around the world have a different type of sports that they play every day and that they love and care about. And that's community-driven, that's sports that we play with our neighbors, that's sports that's about individual and group transformation, and oftentimes actually healing. There's lots of really tremendous projects. So Mike's going to talk a little bit about some of those, and then we hope to, in the Q&A, actually surface from you all some projects you may know about where you live or in other places, so we can really talk about the sports that we want, the other sports that is possible. So with that, Mike James.
Thank you. Well, it's good to be here in Detroit. I think the last time I was here to see some big sports over here was the Steelers and Seattle in the Super Bowl. And I am from Chicago. I've been a longtime community activist. I'm also a businessman. I have a restaurant called the Heartland Cafe, which basically came out of my politics. And we serve a lot of vegetarian food as well as buffalo, but we don't get any vegetables from Arizona at this time. I played football at Lake Forest College, and it was American-style football. I was a tackle. We used to go both ways, as they said then, defense and offense. And it was something I enjoyed doing every year. You got to eat more food when you went for dinner. I liked the wind sprints in the fall. I liked the games, but I didn't necessarily like the coaches. I ended up going out to Berkeley to study sociology, was in the free speech movement, ended up in being a national officer of Students for Democratic Society, and then I started an organization called Rising Up Angry in Chicago, which is kind of part of the Rainbow Coalition that came out of Chicago with the Black Panther Party, the Young Lords, Rising Up Angry, the Young Patriots. And I like to say that we helped elect Harold Washington the mayor, and that all led to Obama. And I've got my criticisms of Obama, but I'm really rooting for him, and I think we have to work real hard to push him and push him from the bottom up. The way I got into Athletes United for Peace was during the time I was in Rising Up Angry, which was basically an organization of what we called greasers, which was a term in Chicago for white working-class youth, kind of slicked back hair, becoming longer as they came back from NAM, smoking weed, combat boots, A1 stay pressed pants or baggy pants, band line shirts. These were tough kids from the neighborhood. And we started, when we first started going around and said we had to build something that so that the white people from the working class that could ally with the Panthers and the Young Lords, we would go and challenge these kids in the neighborhood to baseball games. And then we'd say, okay, it's going to be co-ed. You know, get some of the young women, and we'll choose up sides. You'll have some of your guys with us. We'll be with you. And we did that. And it led to, besides our legal programs, our health clinic, a lot of the things that we did, we also developed a group called Sports for the People. And we started a kind of a volleyball league in a park for all the political groups would have teams. The Women's Liberation Union in Chicago, Salcedo Press, Rising Up Angry, various people. We'd get together, and sports was recreation. Sports was fun. I had met a guy named Dave Magacy, who was featured in Dave Zirin's book. Dave was an All-American out of Syracuse, 63, played in the Orange Bowl. He went on to play for the Cardinals, and he wrote a great book called Out of Their League. And I'm mentioning that book because we had met when he had come to meet a woman named Peggy Terry, who we ran for vice president. She was a hillbilly woman out of Chicago who ran with Eldridge Cleaver for when he ran for the presidency. So Magacy and I taught a class called Sports Consciousness and Social Change. He taught that class at Stanford at the Free University. He had Elway in his class. And then all of a sudden, there was a guy named Phil Shinnick. And Phil Shinnick and John Thomas, two Olympians, when Carter boycotted the Moscow Olympics in 1980, they invited Soviet athletes to come to the Kansas Relays. And they issued a statement about sports. And that was kind of the start of Athletes United for Peace. I wasn't one of the original guys. I got invited by Guy Benjamin, who was later out of Stanford and a 49er quarterback backing up Montana, to go to Nicaragua. And we went to Nicaragua, and we played baseball. We played in prisons. We played with Sandinista soldiers, Matagalpa Estelí. We had a great time. I went back the next year. There was a real difference in the 2 years. First year, everybody was kind of joyous and happy in the communities. The second year, that Contra war was getting really heavy. But we played baseball then. We went to the Soviet Union, in the old Soviet Union, and we played baseball in Moscow and in Donetsk. We taught Soviet Olympic athletes who wanted to learn baseball. We taught them the fundamentals of baseball. We had a race with the Donetsk miners who were on strike. And what I started to do in Chicago was I said, we have to take this from what was pretty much an organization of elite athletes who were a little bit political. I said, we have to figure a way to make this a little bit more mass-based. So in Chicago, we started sponsoring softball teams, volleyball teams. We started having these 5K races. We do five of them a year now, the Sweetheart Run, the Heat of the Spring Chase, the Heat of the Summer Run, the Heartland Harvest Run, and the last race of the year. We also started to do what we call street sprints, which is like, and I'm putting this all out there because we're basically looking for folks who are political, who want to touch other people, either just to have fun with other political people, but also to involve new people, young people, to touch them, you know, kind of give them a little vibe, turn them around, get them to think. You started talking about how do we deal with these professional athletes. Well, let's get them while they're younger. So we did these street sprints, which is something you could set up anywhere. You know, you just get a street, get some kids, and you have little races. The organization is a little bit some old guys and some women, too. Donna DiVerona, who was an Olympian, is on the board. There's some a chapter of Primo athletes in Cuba. In California, a guy named Doug Harris, who played basketball in Europe, he's been running AUP out there, and they did voter registration, hoops for voter registration, late-night basketball, and he does a bunch of digital academy stuff with kids. In New York, Phil Shinnick, who was the last white guy to have the long jump record and the founder of AUP, he works with various NGOs, and they got a lot of plans for stuff going on in Africa. In Chicago, we do races, we sponsor teams, we have events. And in El Paso, Texas, we're affiliated with a group called Basketball in the Barrio. Some of you may know of a coach named Russ Bradbird, who has a great new book out called 40 Minutes of Hell about the great Nolan Richardson, who is from the Segundo Barrio in El Paso, black guy in a Chicano community or Latino community. And Russ put together a basketball camp because when he was working for Don Haskins, he recruited Hardaway. Then he worked for Henson up at New Mexico State. These people would run these camps. And as Russ said, the basketball coach is making more than 40 English teachers for your freshman kids come in and make collectively. And he didn't think that was right. And they charged big money for these camps. So he started Basketball in the Barrio, where for $1, kids come for 3 days. And basketball is only the hook. We get them to come. They do dribbling drills, a lot of drills. But we have all kind of cultural activities, whether it be dancers, whether it be muralists, whether it be storytellers. We've had a lot of people come through there, political people. We had what's her name? Tony, the basketball gal? Tony Smith, who, remember during the Iraq War, she was playing basketball and she turned her back when they did the American flags at Pledge of Allegiance. We had a woman who was one of those two women who were captured by the Iraqis, and the white woman got all the credit, and Shauna, I think her name is, did not. She has a new book out. It's a great camp. What I think is important is that I grew up believing, or I developed the belief, that what makes us human is the ability to reason, to think, to create, to love, to be free. I also think that we're all born with natural athletic abilities and a desire to move our bodies and to have fun. And I think somewhere along the way, the system takes that out of us. Kind of, we give it up. The sports is only for people who are really, really good at it. And sports is, you know, it's more competition than friendship. But when I was getting into, came back to sports through politics, basically the Chinese were around and we were rooting for them a lot then, and they said friendship first, competition second. So Athletes United for Peace basically is an organization that is wide open for anyone to get involved with. I just want to tell you what we came up with last year as a statement. Athletes United for Peace, AUP, is a broad-based organization for athletes. We recognize and include all individuals who participate in sport and physical fitness at any levels as athletes. Athletes United for Peace members understand that sport, physical fitness, and athletics is a positive force for demonstrating the profound connection and interdependence we share with our fellow human beings and all life on the planet. AUP members agree to participate in their sport and athletic activities in the spirit and promotion of sportsmanship and goodwill among competitors, practice supportive and respectful relations in their communities, and encourage nonviolent resolution of conflict between individuals, social groups, communities, and nation states. And I'm going to pass that around. If anyone wants to sign up, at least we'll have your email. I could go on, but I think my time's probably up.
All right. So do we have any questions or comments right there? You want to stand up and talk real loud? Yeah.